Oh yeah, why don't we just have a private solution to this problem? Shift the flow of wealth. And I'll tell you why that's not a option. Because again, when these founders signed their term sheets, they made a commitment in order, they made a deal with the devil. I hate to use inflammatory language, but they made a deal with the devil that in order to fund my idea and take the fast track to innovate or to grow, that we have a fiduciary duty to shareholders, that they will maximize their compensation, and this is done at the expense of the Oliver Anthonys of the world.
Dun 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 da. Dun 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 da. Dun 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 da. Dun 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 dun
This
da.
sculpted narrative goes out to all the giants upon whose shoulders I stand. If I can see further, it is only because of their storied vision. Let me begin with Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman was.
What's up? What's up? What's up? What's up? How are you doing today? Hello, neighbors. Welcome to another episode of Spread Love FM, the podcast. This is Trev, the Brooklyn activist, coming to you with another episode. Hopefully, you will enjoy it. I thank you, thank you, thank you for joining me here and for allowing me to share the message from the one and only to you. So, why don't we get started? So, today we have kind of a tongue twister. Rich men explain rich men north of Richmond. These are four tech billionaires who, given their feedback on the song, they had a few things to say, and I got a few things to say back. So stay tuned for that. We also have an Oliver Anthony inspired conversation between politically distanced friends. A friend of mine and I are reconnected because of this song. And we'll have a bit of my review on that. Nothing live again, just a review. And then we will have our 20th Century Journals, Advice to a Younger Me. And we will actually be doing a rereading of last week's because I think it's pertinent to this episode. So, without any further ado, why don't we get started? First, we have a few announcements. FYA.NYC, the best luggage storage in New York City. If you are on your travel days coming in or departing from New York City, and you don't want to be lugging your bags around, call FYA.NYC or log on to the website FYA.NYC. Book your luggage storage. FYA.NYC, which you can see right here, will pick up your bags, hold them while you tour the city, and deliver them to either your hotel, your Airbnb, your home, or if you're leaving to the airport, to your cruise port, any port, wherever you are leaving from. There's nothing more convenient than having your bags picked up and delivered for you while you enjoy your beautiful travel day in our lovely city. So, first of all, I would like to talk about this song. I mean, we spoke about it in the last episode. It's still getting a lot of engagement. I got off of social media, but we are still using YouTube. And I posted this Oliver Anthony review, and it was sent to me by a friend of mine. And it's a friend of mine that I've known him since 98, 99. I think it's okay to use his name. His name is Mark. There are many Marks in this world, so good luck. And ever since right around the time of the pandemic, you know, there's the political climate in this country was out of control. Even before that, leading up to that, with Trump and the left and the right, and it was just it's been tense. And we know. I mean, I don't have to tell anybody about that. And we had, I guess we got into it in via text, and I think even before that, everybody was treading on, eggshells in terms of how do you engage people who you suspect or think may not be politically or socially aligned. But Mark and I, just a bit of history, we shared office space in 2002 in Manhattan. Sat at a desk where we would literally sit across from each other every single morning, 5 days a week. And we were friends. We were really, really good friends. And we would have, back then it was the newspaper. We were bringing in the newspaper. We were aging ourselves. Well, I already did with the date. And we would discuss, topics in the newspaper. We would discuss. There was nothing off limits. Just to make it clear, Mark is white. I am black. We come from different backgrounds. He's from Connecticut. I am from Brooklyn, New York City. But we had no issues talking about anything and everything. And this is how it was over the years. And we had a few incidents, ins and outs, disagreements, of course, as any friends would have, but we could always get together and have a really good, in-depth conversation about anything. Until 2020 came, the pandemic came. And, it was in the air. Is Trump handling the vaccine thing well? And that was the topic of our discussion. And I mean, I'll tell you this about Mark. He always had an open mind, so I consider that I have an open mind as well. But we 2020 was crazy. And we said a few things that I wasn't comfortable with. I made some assumptions. He probably made some assumptions about me, and it just became, I'd rather just not talk about it. I went into my activism, the Brooklyn activists, as Black Lives Matter, the whole deal. He did his own thing, and we would have these texts that were like there was an elephant in the room, and we knew it, but we didn't want to address it. I think in some way we were trying to preserve our friendship. And so the years passed, and that elephant grew bigger with each passing year, to the point where, it was, you would start creating these stories, is he there on January 6th? Does he agree with that? And I know what I was doing. I was in the fight in the streets protesting. And in a way, I didn't even want to be bothered. I didn't even want to come close to anybody who didn't align with, fighting for what I considered was right. And just for the record, I'm not making any commentary on either point of the political spectrum here. I'm making a point about our friendship. And we still had a working relationship. I had the delivery company for your arms, which you see right here. The luggage storage is related to that as well. And he had his business, and his business needed delivery. So we would work together and very cordially and be respectful and the whole deal. And it was like, let's get through, in the back of our minds, I guess, thinking, let's get through this time and maybe our friendship can get through it as well. We've been friends 20 years, like we can't just let that kind of die because of views that are not necessarily substantiated or whatever. Anyway, to kind of cut to the chase here. So in recent months, I moved down to Florida. He moved down to Florida. Both of us were in New York. We're now both living in Florida. And I guess that was kind of like another thing that we could talk about, but kind of knew that, I'm down here in Florida, which is Trump country. He's down here in Florida as well. Trump country. Like, but in recent months, you know, I reached out to him about my activism with Spread Love, and he was supportive. You know, I'm like, okay, wow, that's cool. And but he never really reached out to me on a political level until about a week ago. You know, I think it was a little more than a week ago when he sent me the Oliver Anthony video, and he asked me, "What are your thoughts?" And, you know, with all of this baggage that was there, I was very suspicious. Not suspicious, I would say. I was surprised, but not sure where it was coming from. Is this, you know, a response to my asking of support from my activism? Is he going to be now asking for support from his side of the political spectrum, which is all assumptions, by the way, just let me clarify that. And I watched the video, and I had a honest, genuinely strong, positively strong reaction to it, which I shared with him. And it was only after I shared this reaction that he shared his feeling about it and how he really loved the message that was sent through this song. So that happened, and I felt so strongly about it that I posted the video, which is how many of you probably found, subscribed to this channel. And there was a lot of engagement, and in that engagement, messages of love and of, and I'm not talking political now. I know people are ready to jump on, you know, either side of this debate, but I'm talking about support for the friendship that was. And you could probably go back and look at the messaging yourself, and it was like, you know, reach out to your friend. Maybe this is a cue, or this is a in or window or opening. Reach out to your friend. And I didn't know if I was ready to do that. You know, I really didn't. I was like, okay, I shared the video. I feel strongly about it. I shared that with you, but am I going to make a big deal out of this? But then after reading the comments and then watching more of the videos from Anthony Oliver, I was just kind of moved to hear his messaging about reach out to a neighbor. And it was our, you know, look, hello neighbor. We got this here, hello neighbor. It's actually part of our platform. And this is why I guess it resonated with me as well. Hello neighbor, reach out to your neighbor. And I'm thinking of, okay, I'm going to go reach out to folks on the right, which was always my intention, just for the record. My activism was to reach out to people across the political spectrum, and you may have picked up on that in my previous videos, but it inspired me to do it even more. There's one message that we wanted to share, which is we are all in this together. But in thinking that this is going to inspire me to reach out to people on the right, I'm thinking, how can I reach out to people on the right when I can't even reach out to my good friend of over 20 plus years? You know, what kind of hypocrisy is that? And so I sent him a text, and the text read, "Hey Mark, hope you're good. Would you have any interest in connecting via Zoom, just you and I, to talk? No expectations. Feels like something should come out of this video. Even if it's the kind of conversation we used to have back in the day, I just wanted to put that offer out there." And Mark responded. I sent that late at night. You can see the time there. The next morning, Mark responded, "Hey, Trev, all good here. I'd be up to chat. Today's not a great day, though. Maybe tomorrow or over the weekend." And yeah, so We spoke yesterday. Was it yesterday? Well, we spoke yesterday or the day before? We spoke. So we spoke, and we had a conversation lasted an hour and a half. And after some, checking in on the families and the move to Florida, we got down to the elephant. We addressed the elephant in the room. And, he would tell me that, he's not on either side of the political spectrum, but when he hears something that he does not agree with, he would vocalize that. And I would share with him that, I'm not in a corner just taking sides just for the sake of taking sides, that my messaging is that we are all in this together and that we need to work together. And we went deeper into the, we would bring up things about how, I assumed that he was a Trumpster and he assumed that I was with Antifa. We had a laugh about that. And we spoke about things that we used to speak about. Like he, it was the funny, one funny part of the conversation was, he wanted to address the reactions of the Anthony Oliver video and how he noticed that black people were reacting as well. And he hesitated before he said black and asked, "Do I have permission to say black, Trevor?" And I laughed, which is what we used to do. And then he reminded me that back in the day he would say African American, and that I would laugh at him like, "I'm not an African American, I'm black, just say it," And that right there reminded me right there that's who we were, It wasn't about saying something and being afraid to say something, addressing something and not being able to address it in the way that you feel. And this is what this video has done. It's kind of opened up avenues of dialogue. And two people who were not on either side of the political spectrum, but just reflecting the views that they thought were right. In the end, we just wanted to do what is right. And we were afraid to say certain things because the world would pile on. And in a nutshell, my friend Mark, the positivity that came out of this, the one thing that the big takeaway was that after all of this, 3 years of wondering and coming up with these imaginary demons, that Mark was just Mark. He's the same independent thinking, open-minded, always asking, always questioning, but always with a good heart, always with love. It was the same guy. He wasn't a person that had any ill will for black people or, people of any race. He was just the same guy. The same guy that used to sit across from each other in that Chelsea studio and say good morning and then talk about what's on the front page, regardless of the content, regardless of, And this was a conversation that was so relieving. And you could exhale and say, "Mark, it's good to get together again. Thank you for allowing me to share how I felt and for sharing how you felt." And that made all the difference. So I share this to say that, even after I shared the video, and I mentioned this in the last video, there were folks from different parts of the political spectrum who questioned or wondered or kind of went back into a corner and reacted from that corner. And this conversation from an old friend that we spent every single day for 2 or 3 years in the same office, right across from each other, sharing the rent, and been through 17 more years of talking and being able to have long conversations, that with everything that's happening in the world, that you should just reach out, just talk, and don't talk afraid to say something that you think may make somebody uncomfortable. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. What it's not supposed to be is fueled by a narrative of division. What it's not supposed to be is not being able to tell somebody how you feel, because for fear that you will get canceled. And I know I'm purposely using words that may cause people on either side of the political spectrum to retreat or to cancel this message. And I'm saying that we've got to stop that. We can't keep doing that. It is not sustainable. As long as we are coming with love, we may have different narratives, that we all learn different narratives. We come from different backgrounds. We are not going to know the same way to address issues. These issues are uncomfortable. Give some grace. I speak about love and spreading love. Love requires grace. Love requires a tremendous amount of grace. Allow your neighbor to say African American when he wants to say black, or black when he wants to say African American. Allow your parent or your uncle to say he when he should say they. Allow your coworker to say capitalism when he should have said crony capitalism. The point is not the words. The point, let me correct that. What's more important is the meaning and the goal. What's less important are the words that may be charged with political or social or economic implications. Even in my video, and I said capitalism, and I have my feelings about capitalism, but it's a word that I didn't use for a long time, and I almost regret using it in the video that so many of you have responded to, because it was only weeks before that I started using the word again, and I realized why I didn't use it, because when you name it, it comes with baggage, it comes with giving people an excuse to say that you are this or you are that, as opposed to listening to the nuance in your argument. So I'll leave you with this one last thing that my friend and I joked about. And we spoke about the left and the right and the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And we both asked, where is the nuance in these arguments? Where are those who will hear somebody say something and instead of running to their corner, ask, oh, what do you mean by that? And the joke that we shared amongst each other is, you know, where is the nuanced party? I would like to share a track that encapsulates this conversation that I had with my friend, and encapsulate something that we should all be doing, which is connecting, saying hello to your neighbor. And it's a track from the Sewoto Gospel Choir, This Little Light of Mine. And as I do, I will share my inspiration and the feeling as the track plays. So if you want to check out the track without my voiceover, then you can find it on YouTube, Soweto Gospel Choir, the Soweto Gospel Choir, This Little Light of Mine.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine.
Let it shine.
I'm gonna let it shine.
This little light of mine.
I'm gonna let it shine.
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 Oh, Mlela.
Puse
matanje.
Puse matanje.
Oh, Mlela.
Oh,
Mlela.
Puse matanje.
Oh, Mlela. Oh, Mlela.
Puse matanje.
Oh, glory of Hela, Lila Kalot
before. You must be sure you need him now.
Oh, oh,
sure you need him now.
You must be sure
you need him now.
Oh, glory of Hela.
You all got lights. Let him shine. Maybe you have a neighbor that you haven't spoken to in a while. An old friend, like my old friend Mark, that because of the political climate, the relationship was strained and you haven't spoken to him, or you speak and it's distance. There's an elephant in the room. Why don't you take that light out in your pocket, that phone, that attention form, and use that light for some good. Go through your contacts, look through your friends. Who is it that you haven't spoken to in a while? Maybe there's a neighbor there that needs to hear a voice of positivity. A neighbor that may be a different religion, a different color, different political persuasion. Reach out to that neighbor. Hey, how you doing? You want to grab lunch? Hello, neighbor. Or maybe there's a neighbor that you see all the time that you just never said hi. You know, we live in cities, and there's so many of us that live in a city of millions, and we feel like we are the only one. So say hello to your neighbor. Find that light in you. That light, you have a message to share, a message of love. Your neighbors are lights. They have messages to share with you as well. Get all of these lights together. Burn bright. A brighter light. The sum of us. Thank you, neighbors, for allowing me to share this message of love and positivity. The Soweto Gospel Choir. So yeah, I'd like to share an article that I read. The title of the article is from The Atlantic, Why So Many Americans Have Stopped Going to Church. And they have this thing they call wokeism. And this is just a passage. And workism sounds like wokeism, another one of those words. But this is workism. People who work too much and... this is one of the reasons that they say that people are not going to church anymore. So I want to read a little bit about it just to share this, and maybe you could get the article yourself. It's behind the paywall, so, you know, whatever. I guess a friend sent this to me. Our jobs are never meant to shoulder the burdens of a faith, and they are buckling under the weight. A staggering 87% of employees are not engaged at their job. According to Gallup, that number is rising by the year. Even so, for those who have come to view work as the guiding principle of life, other priorities can quickly fall by the wayside. The underlying challenge for many is that their lives are stretched like a rubber band about to snap, and church attendance ends up feeling like an item on a checklist that's already too long. At its core, the issue is not just church attendance, Meadow argues, but rather what American society has become. The problem in front of us is not that we have a healthy, sustainable society that doesn't have room for church. The problem is that many Americans have adopted a way of life that has left us lonely, anxious, and uncertain of how to live in community with other people. Meadow's point here reminded me of one of my favorite episodes of our podcast, How to Talk to People, in which the host discussed the role of public spaces in building community. Places such as coffee shops, churches, and libraries can serve as truly shared spaces where people mingle and make new friends. But even in those places, host Julie Beck notes, I've observed hustle and bustle. People are on a mission, what she and producer Rebecca Rashid call American efficiency culture, makes it so that we're just not incentivized to take it slow, sit down, and meet someone new. Beck is getting at the same point as Meta. Many Americans seem to have forgotten how to create truly deliberate communities with one another. I've painted a pretty negative picture thus far about the future of community and spirituality in America, whatever religion or practice a person might abide by. But a competing trend is humming along too. Some Americans are rewriting the rules for what an intentional or spiritual life can look like. In The Atlantic in January, metrics such as church attendance might no longer be the most accurate proxy for America's religious affiliation. Although participation in traditional religious settings, churches, synagogues, mosques, schools, etc., is in decline, signs of life are popping up elsewhere in conversations with chaplains, in communities started online that end up forming in-person bonds as well, in social justice groups rooted in shared faith, they wrote. Meta, for his part, arrived at an ambitious way for churches to bring Americans back into the fold after reading The Great Dechurching. Maybe churches could better serve their members by asking more of them. A vibrant, life-giving church requires more, not less time and energy from its members. It asks people to prioritize one another over our career, to prioritize prayer and time reading scripture over accomplishment. Churches could model better, truer sorts of communities, ones in which the hungry are fed, the weak are lifted up, and the proud are cast down. So I shared that because it's very relevant to what it is that we're doing, and the spirituality and the selflessness is the thing that we were put above all else. So other than love, God is love. And, you know, church doesn't have to be in the church that I grew up in, where you sit in a building and, you know, have stuff that's read to you. Church is just community. In my opinion, church is love, selfless love. So take that for what it's worth. You can read the rest of the article in The Atlantic. I'd like to take this moment. 20th Century Journal's advice to a younger me. And I'll just read the passage that kind of relates to that article. And I read this last time, but it has more meaning now. And it speaks about the materialism and where that leads. And the anxiety that's mentioned in that article is something that was happening with me before I had my spiritual transformation. So let me just read the page, and we read this last week. As one woman put it, what is desired in men is ambition and intelligence, and the rewards for intelligence and ambition in this society is material wealth. What is being said here is that money is a measuring stick of a man's ingenuity, is what I meant to say, even though I spelled it wrong. And if a man doesn't have money, it more often than not means he doesn't measure up. The attitude is that as smart as he may think he is, he must be doing something wrong. And I myself believe in this way of thinking. I believe I am very intelligent, and in this land of dreams and opportunity, I will be clocking dollars one day. So I read that because, you know, that was me. I pursued that for a long time. And my advice to my younger self now is that it's a dead end. The emptiness that you feel at the end of that pursuit is real. It's something you will ask yourself, is there has got to be more? You may reach your goal, but in the end, you will ask, how can I now be selfless after years wasted? And you may not even get there and still ask yourself, you know, is there more? And that's the question I ask myself. So an advice to a younger me would be to be more selfless, to don't value the material wealth, the narrative of rugged individualism over, you know, radical selflessness. You know, that's where the love is, and that's spirituality. And that doesn't have to happen in a church setting. That can happen you and your neighbor, you know, you and your family get together like I do every weekday morning at 6 a.m. for a prayer group. That's meaningful. You know, go to your local store and ask, how can I pay something forward? You know, that's meaningful. And that's more meaningful than all the dollars in the world. I keep telling the story. I got less than $20 in my bank account, and I'm happier than I've ever been. So I just want to share that, and take it for what it's worth. So now let's get down to the nitty-gritty. So we are now going to share a podcast that was shared to me actually by my friend Mark, which we spoke about in the beginning. He shared one of the reaction videos that he saw. A podcast that I actually followed, but I haven't followed it in a few years. But it's a podcast All In, I think it's the name of it. I'll put it in the show notes. It's a podcast that is basically for billionaires who listen to the Oliver Anthony track and had their own opinions. So let's just give a listen, and I'll come back on the other side. This is a kind of a lengthy listen, so I may actually speak as this plays, like I do with the music. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. I'm going to kind of play by ear here.
I think it's both right, Sax. You could have a group of people who are unhappy with their current condition, and there are people from around the world who look at America and say, I want to be part of that system. If only I could be in that country. In fact, all three of your parents, Freeburg, Sachs, and Chamath, said that. I need to get there. I need to get to America. Sachs, your thoughts on Chamath's point about this disparity, this paradox?
So the way I interpret this word populism is failure of the elites. When you hear people expressing populist thoughts, what they're really saying is that the people running this country, the ruling class, the elite, has failed. And we've just seen with 2 years of COVID that the ruling class got everything wrong, pushed these insanely destructive lockdowns, lied about every aspect of the virus, and pushed a vaccine that didn't work. So I don't want to rehash COVID, but the point is just the elite, the ruling class, completely failed, and yet their failure was covered up by the media.
It's the best example. Let's just say it. Let's just call it what it is. It is the best example.
Right. So I think people are justifiably angry about this failure of the elite combined with the lack of accountability because there's not honesty about what they're getting wrong. And you see this pattern repeated over and over again. So I think it's repeated in terms of how we got into this completely unnecessary Ukraine war. It's repeated in terms of the crisis we've had at the border. It's repeated in terms of the export of all of these industrial jobs to other countries. And that has
collapse of cities, collapse of cities,
the collapse of cities with, you know, again, we have hundreds of thousands of people living on the streets. I think all of these things have made a huge difference in the lives of many ordinary people in the country. And so, yeah, this is a land of opportunity for people who have certain kinds of skills. Listen, if you are technologically inclined, it's still a great country. We're in this industry. We know there's lots of opportunity. It's always a great time to start a company. But many people in the country have been adversely impacted by these policies. And there appears to be no willingness of the ruling class to admit the problem and make changes. The line, Jason, you quoted, where it was kind of like, they know we know, and they keep doing it anyway.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a line from Solzhenitsyn, who said that we know they are lying. They know they are lying. They know we know they are lying. We know they know we know they are lying, but they are still lying. That's
profound.
The vibe I'm getting is this Solzhenitsyn line.
Nick, if you just pull up the link.
So I want to just jump in here that, not that he is wrong, but it also skirts responsibility of the damage that the system has done. So yes, you can have short stretches or decades long of failure by one class or one group or another. But how about looking at the centuries long failure of inclusion and exploitation? And again, I'm not using any of the isms here, but the system that made these billionaires wealthy is one that, is built on the labor of the very people like, Anthony Oliver, who is, paid nothing. And when you have that group of people fighting amongst another group of people who are paid nothing, while, there's a percentage of the people who have more than half the wealth in the country, how did we get there? It's not from the last 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, even 100 years. It's a system that allows you to exploit and allows the exploiters to have the exploited compete for minimal resources. And that's not addressed here. So to say that the last 3 years is what has caused the pain of the Oliver Anthonys of the world is, come on. Yeah. Okay. I don't even think I have to debate that point. Yes, it is a symptom of something greater, which so far I haven't heard addressed, which is a system that funnels money upward and out of community to the wealthy and the 1%, and that comes back to the Oliver Anthonys of the world for pennies on the dollar. That's a 500-year problem. And again, I'm not using the isms. I am not anti anything. I am about what's happening and how can we build, and there might be something new that comes out of it. Anyway, I will get off my soapbox to hear a little bit more, and I'll get back on after the next few comments.
I think I just sent. This is a really important, I think, data set for us to all look at and for everyone to understand, what's gone on in the United States. This shows in 2020 dollars per capita income in the US by quintile. So the top 5% of earners in the US, since call it the mid 90s, have seen a near doubling of their earnings. The top quintile, which is the top 20% of earners in the United States, have seen their earnings climb by 60% since that time period. But the rest of America, the other 80%, have been flat.
Yep.
And I think if you are born into the United States or told the story of the American dream, the story of the American dream is you can come here, work hard, be smart, put in the effort, put in the time, and you'll be able to progress in your life in terms of comforts and assets and all these things. And for most of Americans, that story has not played out. They've worked hard. They've put in the effort. They've tried to be smart. They followed the rules. They've done what the systems and the governments have said you should do in order to get the rewards. And they're left with flat earnings over several decades. And that's the story of America right now. And because of this, the top 20%, the top 5% have acquired, an outsized amount of the assets, an outsized amount of the income, as we all know and have all benefited from. And the vast majority of Americans that have been working jobs and working careers.
I have a question for Freeburg. Freeburg, do you think that we should implement policies to change the lines on this graph?
That's exactly what I was going to ask. Yeah.
I want to reference you guys to the Tim Ferriss interview with Charles Koch from a couple of years ago. In that interview, he gives a really good example, and I'm going to mess this up a bit. But he talks about how certain women that are hairdressers in the inner city, they want to go do this hair braiding thing. But in order to do it, they have to pay thousands of dollars to school to get certified, and then they have to go to the city to get a license in order to be able to do that job. So the economic cost of getting there is insurmountable for them. And there's countless examples like this, where in the US, we've created policies that have attempted to be forms of protection or perhaps be forms of income generation for cities and governments and so on, that in the process, unfortunately, have limited the mobility of people that want to be individual earners and entrepreneurs in the US. I think that is the first thing I would do to address this problem. Give every American the opportunity to be an entrepreneur, to build their own path.
Do you think that hair braiding licensing, fixing that problem, will cause the dashed black line or the blue line to shrink? Or I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, should those lines shrink?
Yeah.
I don't think it's the government's role, right? I mean,
I'll tell you, I just want to hear
Friedberg's answer, Jason. Okay.
I'll answer the question.
Okay.
I've said this in the past. If you shrink those lines, you will limit overall progress. And what I mean by progress is improvements in productivity, improvements in advances in technology, in business, in economic growth, because we've seen this many times in the past. There's a certain limit on taxation. So one method is to tax, right? Pull more money out of the top earners and redistribute it. The problem is when you do that, there's less capital in the hands of those who have proven themselves to be good at driving productivity and improving access for goods and commodities and things that are cheaper for everyone. So there is a cost to doing that. And that has been, this is played out. I mean, this is the Roman Empire. This is the British Empire. This is played out countless times in history. In recent years, it's played out probably half a dozen times.
You're evading the question. I just want to know what you think. What do you think?
I think that there's an important balance to strike. So I don't think it's about taking away from the top as much as it's about enabling the bottom, if that makes sense.
It doesn't, because that's what everybody says they want to do. And it's been 50 years of people saying that. It doesn't work. What?
Yeah.
So he's not going to answer. So you answer, Chamath. What do you think?
I'm just telling you there's a consequence to doing, you know, whatever we want to do to try and make everyone equal and end up in a
social state. Here's my issue. The way that you present it, like you tell it in a language, and even I felt it, where I was like, wow, this guy's really empathizing. Wow, my God, he's really. But then the follow up to like, well, what would you do is non-existent. And I think that that's the real problem. A lot of people want to pretend that this is an issue and they want to get the sympathy of the masses by giving the populist rhetoric of why this is an issue. But when push comes to shove and the question is, do you believe that the dashed black line or the blue line should be legislatively brought down to meet the other lines? People just evade the question. In my perspective, the answer is no, you cannot do that. And the reason why United States GDP is where it is because of that dashed line. It's an existence proof of the fact that this is the largest economy in the world. And so one has to make a really simplistic decision, which is, do you want economic supremacy and then try to figure out ways of rebalancing things, or do you not? I say you absolutely must start with that, which means that that dashed line and that blue line will always have a rate of acceleration that is greater than the other lines. And that's just natural OPEX leverage that exists in any company. If you look at a company with 50% EBITDA margins versus a company with 15% EBITDA margins because one uses technology and the other one doesn't. Capitalism is rife with these examples.
Yeah. Chamath, that is the smartest, best thing you've said in 142 episodes of the All In Pod.
So I let that play on for a while because I wanted them to present the anti-government argument, which is the one that's most used, which is that competition breeds innovation. And my pushback to that is this, and again, I'm not any ism, and I don't have any ill will towards billionaires individually. What I want to say is that the system, he points to the Roman Empire and to this, you know, all of these isms that failed. And what's to say that this system is not failing? And I think the evidence is there. Not only is whatever innovation we have, technically, when you look at environmentally, it's almost a line going in the opposite direction. whatever wealth is, GDP is coming, that's increasing the American GDP. It's at the expense of a country in Africa somewhere. It is, in a way, it is a zero-sum game. Now, to answer the question about do you think that line should be legislated down, I also, this is not where I am active. This is not where my activism lies. Where I think, what I think can happen, and what I think, what we are fighting for, is that the control, that power to shrink that gap lies here, not with the government, and definitely not with the billionaires, because they have a duty to their shareholders. Once they sign that term sheet, you know, they're off. They can't really turn that ship. They can't, legally cannot turn that ship around. And when I say it lies here, what I mean to say is that by knowing that your dollar flowing out of your community to a Walmart or a Target or a Publix or an Apple, that that's your power. You're giving up your power to someone who has no intention to make your life better, but to make the shareholders' lives better because they funded their ideas. And what we can do is incentivize local spending. So that power in that dollar that you have, instead of going to an Uber, goes to a collective co-op Uber version alternative that's funded by community, be it Kickstarter or any crowd-funded or private group, collective of people who fund these same great ideas, that these very same entrepreneurs here who maybe didn't know the harm that they are doing by shifting, channeling that money up and out of communities and then being released into the system that we call this ism, which I wouldn't use the word, and that system that is based on minimizing expenses, which are workers, which are the Oliver Anthonys of the world, and maximizing profits, which is that black line and the billionaires that are making this case. That system goes way, way further back than 10, 20, 50, 100, 200 years ago. That system goes back 500 years ago. And unless these entrepreneurs, these billionaires, went in to their their VC meetings with that knowledge and with the strength to say no because of the knowledge of this cycle of harm that's about to take place if their ideas take off, which, you know, I founded this company not knowing this, Free Your Arms. And it is only after, you know, I didn't take funding, I knew that much not to do that, but I still didn't know that the cycle of harm begins with the founders and also and ends with the community deciding where to send their power. That knowing that on the founder side and on the consumer side is how we non-legislatively, privately shift the flow of wealth so that gap shrinks. As to the innovation argument, which I think is one that's shared common, it's shared frequently, which is that there are a select gifted group of people, the 1% would fall into that category, who push technology, who know how to spend your money and increase the GDP as a result. And they do this because of competing with each other. Well, I have another argument that that same innovation can come from community, that if Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates had the support of the community and they, instead of thinking selfishly about how to grow their companies, thought selflessly about how to grow community, that does not make them any less smarter or ingenious, or they would not come up with great ideas. These ideas happen. They are there. They're out there. But the existing system does not reward that. That cycle needs to be broken. And it's happening. It's happening in mutualism. It's happening in co-ops. But that money is trapped 500 years now. And to get that money out, you need something that incentivizes people. And this is the model that we are building and many people around the planet are building. If you could just incentivize, give away a free phone, give away a book, that attention that's generated from the traffic and the transactions there, monetize that attention for community and not for big tech. That's one way to break the cycle. The money's now going to community. You have something. We do that at Miguel's Latin Market. Free food, free groceries. People, that's free is the most powerful word in marketing. And now that you have the attention of the sponsors and of the shoppers, you leverage that attention for something that benefits community. And that's a big picture solution. So let's continue.
I think we do a huge disservice by pretending to care and then not seeing the ugly truth. The ugly truth is none of us want the government to try to bring that dashed black line or that blue line down. We want them to stay out of our way. That is the truth.
Yep.
So if you talk to that guy that wrote that song and his 80 million followers,
what do you say to them?
What do you say to them?
I don't know.
Can I take a shot at this?
It's my honest answer. I want to get Saxon. Sax, go.
Okay, look, I think when you see a chart like that, the natural instinct is that you want to argue for redistribution. You basically want to take from one of the top lines and just give it to one of the bottom lines. And I think that only works to a degree. I think it's important that we have a social safety net. But what we've seen is that Marxist redistribution doesn't ultimately work. It actually makes a society poor. I think this is where Chamath is right. The simplistic solutions don't work. We're not going to move from fundamentally a capitalist system to a sort of Marxist redistributive system. But that doesn't mean that we can't do things to improve the situation for the average American. And I think there the policies are more complicated, but I think we could have much more prudent handling of our fiscal situation so that inflation, for example, doesn't eat away the wages of American workers. I think we could have a much more sensible immigration policy so that there's not, I think, a lot of competition for, let's call it, low-end jobs. I think we could have had a better trade policy with China over the last 20 years. I think there are things that we could do that were more nuanced that would have improved the situation for working-class Americans. And we didn't do it. And you compound that with, again, all these elite failures around things like COVID.
I'm going to jump in. And again, so this is what typically happens. They bring up legislative fixes and immediately they jump, oh, you're talking socialism or communism. Now, these are geniuses, billionaire geniuses, right? Quote unquote geniuses. Let me just clarify that. And you mean to tell me that the idea of privatizing a shift in the flow of wealth is something that they haven't come up with? Forget those four. The thousands or whatever it is, number of founders that, you know, walk through Silicon Valley with pitch decks, you know, can't come up with an idea that works for community? No, and if that's the case, okay, well, then I must be the genius because, oh yeah, why don't we just have a private solution to this problem, shift the flow of wealth? And I'll tell you why that's not an option. Because again, when these founders signed their term sheets, they made a commitment they made a deal with the devil. I hate to use inflammatory language, but they made a deal with the devil that in order to fund my idea and take the fast track to innovate or to grow, that we have a fiduciary duty to shareholders that they will maximize their compensation, and this is done at the expense of the Oliver Anthonys of the world. They can't say that because the horse is out the barn. So what do you do? You scapegoat short term. You say that it's COVID. You know, yeah. I mean, like this has not been happening for centuries. You know, I mean, even in the rest example, there's 50 years of this. You know, even that in that very graph, you know, that's graph goes way before COVID. Yet this one billionaire is talking about, you know, the failures of the elite. And I get that because that's the low-hanging fruit in which you can shift the blame to this, you know, the elites, which is on one level divisive without including the billionaires. If you put them all into the same pot, then we have a unifying message, a unifying problem, a unifying body to hold accountable. If we don't, if we say it's just Washington and not Wall Street, then we start to divide. Because the left wants to hold Wall Street accountable. The right now wants to hold DC accountable. We divide. We do not unite. What we need to do is to hold Wall Street and DC accountable, look back past hundreds of years and say the source of this is that money goes out of our communities into Wall Street, which gets paid to lobbyists in DC and which comes to us in the form of legislative decisions that weaken our vote and weaken our voice. So let's continue.
Go from green to orange, orange to red, red to purple to blue, blue to dashed black. That's what really matters. That's why I think this chart is mostly pointless. Because if in fact what you saw was that in any given cohort of people, they were not the cohort before that was in the dashed black line, you would say, wow, we're actually creating wealth distribution in a very unique way, which is an entire new cohort of people are becoming wealthy in every generation. If, however, it's the same 50 people that are in the dashed black line, obviously that's not good. But our lived experience is not that. So I think like the real question is like, can we find a different way of actually telling the truth using this information so that instead of bear hugging random populist sentiments and statements to try to win favor with people, we actually just acknowledge the problem where it lies. That individual that wrote that song, which line is he on? Which line was his father on? And which line will his children be on? That's the critical question. It's not that the line shouldn't exist.
And let me jump in really quickly here just to kind of share my thoughts. Basically, he's saying that if Oliver Anthony, if his kids can move from the low line, from the folks who haven't gained in the past, whatever amount of years it is on that graph, if his kids can move from that lower line to become a 1%, then the system is working. Unfortunately, in this graph, I think they failed to address the fact that it's a zero sum. So for every Oliver Anthony that goes to the top, at least per this graph, you know, that means that somebody else is moving down. Or at the very least, Oliver Anthony goes to the top. His generation succeeds and the others don't have access to that. So in other words, if everybody was to benefit from this, that would be sustainable, you know. But if everybody benefited and were that top line, which is impossible, then the top line will go down. That rate of gain of wealth will be flatter. You know, there's only X amount of resources out there. Unless you inflate, you know, and which is actually happening, the dollar just, you know, oh, it's worth $20 in 20 years as opposed to $15, which actually happens. And again, I don't want to go into the depth of the economics because I'm not an economist. I am an economic activist. But if you were telling me that everybody would be that top line, then by definition, that top line would shrink. And what does that mean? That means that the shareholder somehow found it in their heart to not exploit and not to maximize their profits and minimize their expenses. And that's just not going to happen in this system. We consumers have to make that decision and shift that flow on our own. Anyway, let me continue.
You know,
where did you start? Which line did you start on?
I started in the green.
I know. I'm asking Freeberg. Where did you start? I started between the fourth quartile and the middle quartile.
Right. I mean, when we moved to the U.S., my parents always just looked for gigs that they could make money at.
So you were fourth quartile, you think? 40K?
We had no money. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, we moved to L.A. when I was 6 years old from South Africa, and they worked gigs their entire lives.
Yeah. I think my family went from fourth to the middle, and then my brothers and I all went up to at least one or two lines higher.
By the way, another thing.
I think that's the important story. If you guys read some of the comments on YouTube, which we always argue we should or shouldn't have, but I just want to point this out. There's, to Chamath's point, there's immediate approximation of people based on which quartile or quintile they're in, rather than an approximation on their transversal of the quartiles or quintiles or whatever. I think what's really true about all four of us is that we all transversed the quintiles. We all moved from there to there, and none of us were wealthy just a few years ago. We all, you know, made our way in the world and in the United States in a way that we would not have been able to anywhere else on earth. And I do think that that is the most powerful aspect of American liberalism and democracy. Still, I think this characterization of people based on their wealth is what's so disturbing to me. Because you hear it from Elizabeth Warren, you hear it from AOC, but it discredits the fact that those people typically were not wealthy a few years ago. That the people that should be celebrated are the ones that went from not wealthy to wealthy through the means of creating things that ended up being useful and productive or whatever the system asked for, and they created value there. And I think that the lack of recognition of entrepreneurship, the ability for immigrants to come to this country and transverse these quintiles,
is
one of the challenges. Yeah.
I mean, I'm being very calm in this response, just so you know. So he's basically saying that the fact that you can be a rugged individual and make it from line the masses to the 1% is what we should be celebrating, that they need to be celebrated. Not the fact that they signed a term sheet that said, oh yes, you have an idea that may not be any better than the idea that woman in Africa who's turning plastic into bricks to build houses, that your idea is somehow getting more funded because you are going to make the shareholders wealthy. Not because your idea is so genius, but because they know that you are going to play the game that allows the wealth disparity to continue. So in exchange for you climbing to the top at the expense of the Oliver Anthonys of the world, because they are not, quote unquote, as you put it, the geniuses who create something so great that it should be rewarded just based on their mere genius, not on the fact that you were the chosen one that allows the system to perpetuate. Continue.
Yeah. What do you say to the blue collar worker in Richmond that this guy is speaking to in terms of their ability to transverse those quintiles, to go from low income earner? They're a blue collar worker. They work a union job, or they work as a plumber, or they work in, you know, some manufacturing facility.
This is the point. Job, a teacher. You're not supposed to grin him. So by pretending like this is what they hate. They hate all of you fucking people grin fucking them. Stop grin fucking them. Stop pretending that you care, that you really care, and oh, woe is them. But the reality is, it is implicitly impossible for anybody on this fucking podcast to talk about how this system has not worked for them. Okay. And so what we need to do is actually take a step back and just acknowledge the fact that we were in the green line. We somehow, by a bunch of fate and luck and hard work and opportunity.
I love that he's angry. You know, Oliver Anthony probably got a few hundred dollars in his bank account, but he's angry. Yeah. So very patronizing. Like, this is, he knows what Oliver Anthony wants to hear. He knows what we want to hear. Like, no, we don't want you to say, oh, we're going to give you the truth so that you become one of us. No, that's not what we want to hear. We want us, what we, what I'll tell you what I want to do. I want the Oliver Anthony of the world to do exactly what it is he is doing, which is holding truth to power. And yeah, you could be angry all you want in your whatever fifth or sixth home, but you saying that you are be doing him a favor by preaching the perpetuation of exploitation is completely condescending. It is elitist, and it is why we need to hold the 1% accountable.
And so the real question is, what did that guy, can he do differently? Has he done or shouldn't have done that has kept him in there? And one of the things that I would like to bring up that is really worth exploring for multi-generational Americans, which is not talked about enough, is when we introduced, or when we, I'm talking collectively, we, Lyndon Johnson, really, the war on poverty, that had an inexorable change in the dynamics of America, in black wealth, in white wealth, in the trapped amount of wealth, the destruction of nuclear families. All of these trends started a few years post the introduction of the war on poverty. And nobody talks about that.
So again, you know, looking at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 year spans as if, you know, this hasn't been happening for centuries, as if there were the flow of wealth hasn't been going out of communities and into the 1%, as if it's a single set or trend of policies. It's not taxation. I mean, these are all symptoms. Yeah. So here's the final clip.
Healthcare and all those are secondary and tertiary derivatives of the actual war on poverty. And that was Lyndon Johnson's signature legislation post the assassination of JFK. And nobody really looks at what that actually did to change and potentially misalign incentives in the United States that have compounded to create this issue. So I would say to the Richmond person, I have enough respect for you, sir, to not grin at you and tell you how woe was this graph. I don't know what the solution is. And I think we just need to talk and figure out to see if there are some ideas that can improve the situation. But some of them do come to the fundamental incentives that the government has created that we need to either undo or change.
So we'll end there. Once again, the patronizing, like, yeah, let's not admit the truth because the truth hurts. This is the truth. The truth is that we have to be in power, that you have to continue to send your power to us because we are smart and we will trickle down our wealth to you. And you all should be happy. Let them eat cake. That's why we were here. We are endowed with special abilities, technical skill, and unbounded genius. And I'm not buying it. So to the Oliver Anthonys of the world, you know, I'm sure you're not listening. Thanks for turning on the $8 million. Hopefully many more people will follow in your path and work towards the common man, people like me. I got $20 in my pocket and I'm happy and I'm finding ways to spread the message of love, of selflessness, not selfishness, of community and not rugged individualism, and getting rid of all the isms and connecting and getting off the internets and talking to our neighbors. So that's it from me this week. Thanks again for following us, for all the great comments. And I'm hoping that we can continue this dialogue. I mean, I'm doing Oliver Anthony whenever I see fit. It's not necessarily going to be an Oliver Anthony podcast, but I really appreciate what he said. He's speaking truth to power, and I think more of us need to do that. So thanks again. I'm going to leave you with a clip from Attention, our friends, fellow activists. This is Trev FM, the Brooklyn activist with Spread Love FM, and I'll see you all next time.
This microphone and these speakers are designed to amplify my voice, but why me? I have no simple answer. All I can say is, I believe anyone with something to say should be given the chance to speak and to be heard. Well, I have something to say, and I hope you all will hear me. Just remember, there can be consequences for speaking out. I'm forming an all-out assault against systems of oppression. I stand up here by myself, but I am not alone. I've got more support structures than the Brooklyn Bridge, but I'm not bragging. I'm blessed. If one syllable I speak rings false...